He'd actually run for election to the presidency, if you could call it that. Arnie Van Dam didn't, as a matter of fact. Which you could, since he'd fulfilled the constitutional requirements, a fact on which just about every legal scholar in the nation had agreed, and talked about on every major news network ad nauseum. Well, Jack reminded himself, I wasn't watching much TV back then, was I? But it all really came down to one thing. The people you dealt with as president were very often people whom you would never willingly invite into your home. And it had nothing to do with any lack of manners or personal charm, which, perversely, they usually displayed in abundance. One of the things Arnie had told Jack early on was that the main requirement to enter the political profession was nothing more or less than the ability to be pleasant to people whom you despised, and then to do business with them as if they were bosom friends. So what do we know about our heathen Chinese friends? Winston asked. The current ones, that is. Not much. We're working on that. The agency has a long way to go, though we are started on the road. We still get intercepts. Their phone system is leaky, and they use their cell phones too much without encrypting them. Some of them are men of commendable vigor, George, but none too terribly scandalous that we know about. Quite a few of them have secretaries who are very close to their bosses. The Secretary of the Treasury managed a chuckle. Well, a lot of that going around, and not just in Beijing. Even on Wall Street, Jack inquired, with a theatrically raised eyebrow. I can't say for sure, sir, but I have heard the occasional rumor. Winston grinned at the diversion. And even right here in this room, Ryan reminded himself. They'd changed the rug long since, of course, and all the furniture, except for the presidential desk. One of the problems associated with holding this job was the baggage piled on your back by previous office holders. They said the public had a short memory, but that wasn't true, was it? Not when you heard the whispers, followed by chuckles, and accompanied by knowing looks and the occasional gesture that made you feel dirty to be the subject of the chuckles. And all you could do about it was to live your life as best you could. But even then, the best you could hope for was for people to think you were smart enough not to get caught. Because they all did it, right? One of the problems with living in a free country was that anyone outside this palace/prison could think and say whatever he wished. And Ryan didn't even have the right that any other citizen might have to punch out whatever twit said something about his character that the twit was unwilling to back up. It hardly seemed fair. But as a practical matter, it would force Ryan to visit a lot of corner bars and break a lot of knuckles to little gain. And sending sworn cops or armed Marines out to handle matters wasn't exactly a proper use of presidential power, was it? Jack knew that he was far too thin-skinned to hold this job. Professional politicians typically had hides that made a rhinoceros's look like rose petals, because they expected to have things hurled at them. Some true, some not. By cultivating that thick covering, they attenuated the pain somehow, until eventually people stopped hurling things at them, or such was the theory. Maybe it actually worked for some. Or maybe the bastards just didn't have consciences. You paid your money, and you took your choice. But Ryan did have a conscience. That was a choice he'd made long before. You still had to look in the mirror once a day, usually at shaving time, and there was no easy fix for not being able to like the face you saw there. Okay, back to the PRC's problems, George, the president commanded. They're going to juice up their trade. One way, that is. They're discouraging their own citizens from buying American, but all they can sell, they sell. Including some of Mao's young virgins, probably. What do we have to prove that? Jack, I pay close attention to results, and I have friends in various businesses who shake the bushes and talk to people over drinks. What they learn frequently gets back to me. You know, a lot of ethnic Chinese have some weird medical condition. You get one drink into them, It's like 4 or 5 for us. And the second drink is like chugging a whole bottle of Jack Daniels. But some of the dummies try to keep up anyway. Some hospitality thing, maybe. Anyway, when that happens, well, the talk becomes freer, you know. It's been going on quite a while. But lately, Mark Gant set up a little program. Senior executives who go to certain special places... Well, I do own the Secret Service now, and Secret Service does specialize in economic crimes, right? And a lot of my old friends know who I am and what I do now, and they cooperate pretty nice. And so I get a lot of good stuff to write up. It mainly goes to my senior people across the street.
I'm impressed, George. You cross-decked to CIA?
I suppose I could, but I was afraid they'd get all pissy over turf rights and stuff.
Ryan rolled his eyes at that bit of information.
Not Ed Foley. He's a real pro from way back, and the bureaucracy over at Langley hasn't captured him yet. Have him over to your office for lunch. He won't mind what you're doing. Same thing with Mary Pat. She runs the Directorate of Operations. MP's a real cowgirl, and she wants results, too.
Duly noted.
You know, Jack, it's amazing how much people talk, and the things they talk about under the proper circumstances.
How'd you make all that money on the street, George? Ryan asked.
Mainly by knowing a little more than the guy across the street, Winston replied.
Works the same way for me here.
Okay, if our little friends go forward with this, what should we do?
Jack? No, now it's Mr. President. We've been financing Chinese industrial expansion for quite a few years now. They sell things to us, we pay cash for them, and then they either keep the money for their own purposes on the international money markets, or they purchase things they want from other countries, often things they could as easily buy from us, but maybe 0.5% more expensive from an American manufacturer. The reason it's called trade is that you theoretically exchange something of yours for something of the other guy's. Just like kids with baseball cards, okay? But they're not playing the game that way. They're also dumping some products just to get dollars, selling items here for less than what they sell them to their own citizens. Now, that is technically in violation of a couple federal statutes.
Okay, Winston shrugged. It's a statute we enforce somewhat selectively, but it is on the books, and it is the law. Toss in the Trade Reform Act that we passed a few years ago because of the games the Japs were playing.
I remember, George. It kind of started a little shooting war in which some people got killed, POTUS observed dryly.
Worst of all, perhaps, it had begun the process that had ended up with Ryan in this very room.
Sectrez nodded.
True, but it's still the law, and it was not a bill of attainder meant only to apply to Japan. Jack, if we apply the same trade laws to China that the Chinese apply to us, well, it'll put a major crimp in their foreign exchange accounts.
Is that a bad thing?
No, not with the trade imbalance we have with them now. You know, Jack, if they start building automobiles and play the same game they're playing on everyone else, our trade deficit could get real ugly real fast. And frankly, I'm tired of having us finance their economic development, which they then execute with heavy equipment bought in Japan and Europe. If they want to trade with the United States of America, fine. But let it be trade. We can hold our own in any truly fair trade war with any country, because American workers can produce as well as anybody in the world and better than most. But if we let them cheat us, we're being cheated, Jack. And I don't like that here any more than I do around a card table. And here, buddy, the stakes are a hell of a lot higher.
I hear you, George.
But we don't want to put a gun to their head, do we? You don't do that to a nation state, especially a big nation state, unless you have a solid reason for doing so. Our economy is chugging along rather nicely now, isn't it? We can afford to be a little magnanimous.
Maybe, Jack.
What I was thinking was a little friendly encouragement on our part. Not a pointed gun, exactly. The gun is always there in the holster.
The big gun is most favored nation status, and they know it, and we know they know it. TRA is something we can apply to any country, and I happen to think the idea behind the law is fundamentally sound. It's been fairly useful as a club to show to a lot of countries, but we've never tried it on the PRC. How come?
POTUS shrugged, with no small degree of embarrassment.
Because I haven't had the chance yet. And before me, too many people in this town just wanted to kiss their collective ass.
Leaves a bad taste in your mouth when you do that, Mr. President, doesn't it?
It can, Jack agreed.
Okay, you want to talk this over with Scott Adler. The ambassadors all work for him.
Who do we have in Beijing?
Carl Hitch. Career FSO, late 50s, supposed to be very good, and this is his sunset assignment.
Pay off for all those years of holding coats?
Ryan nodded.
Something like that, I suppose. I'm not entirely sure. State wasn't my bureaucracy.
CIA, he didn't add, was bad enough.
It was a much nicer office, Bart Mancuso thought. And the shoulder boards on his undress whites were a little heavier now, with the 4 stars instead of the 2 he'd worn as comm-sub pack. But no more. His former boss, Admiral Dave Seaton, had fleeted up to Chief of Naval Operations, and then the President, or someone close to him, had decided that Mancuso was the guy to be the next Commander-in-Chief Pacific. And so he now worked in the same office once occupied by Chester Nimitz, and other fine, and some brilliant, naval officers since. It was quite a stretch since plebe summer at Annapolis, lo those many years before, especially since he'd had only a single command at sea, USS Dallas, though that command tour had been a noteworthy one, complete with 2 missions he could still tell no one about. And having been shipmates once and briefly with the sitting president probably hadn't hurt his career very much. The new job came with a plush official house, a sizable team of sailors and chiefs to look after him and his wife. The boys were all away at college now. The usual drivers, official cars, and now armed bodyguards. Because, remarkably enough, there were people about who didn't much care for admirals. As a theater commander, Mancuso now reported directly to the Secretary of Defense, Anthony Brutano, who in turn reported directly to President Ryan. In return, Mancuso got a lot of new perks. Now he had direct access to all manner of intelligence information, including the Holy of Holies, sources and methods, where the information came from, and how we'd gotten it out. Because, as America's principal executor for a quarter of the globe's surface, he had to know it all, so that he'd know what to advise the SecDef, who would, in turn, advise the president of SyncPAC's views, intentions and desires. The Pacific, Mancuso thought, having just completed his first morning intel brief, looked okay. It hadn't always been like that, of course, including recently, when he'd fought a fairly major conflict. War was a word that had fallen very much out of favor in civilized discourse, with the Japanese, and that had included the loss of 2 of his nuclear submarines, killed with treachery and deceit, as Mancuso thought of it, though a more objective observer might have called the tactics employed by the enemy clever and effective. Heretofore he'd been notified of the locations and activities of his various submarines, but now he also got told about his carriers, tin cans, cruisers, and replenishment ships, plus Marines and even Army and Air Force assets, which were technically his as a theater commander-in-chief. All that meant that the morning intel brief lasted into a 3rd cup of coffee, by the end of which he looked longingly to the executive head, just a few feet away from his desk. Hell, his intelligence coordinator, called a J-2, was in fact an Army 1-star doing his joint tour, and in fairness doing it pretty well. This brigadier, named Mike Lahr,
had taught political science at West Point, in addition to other assignments. Having to consider political factors was a new development in Mancuso's career, but it came with the increased command territory. Sinkpack had done his joint tour along the way, of course, and was theoretically conversant with the abilities and orientation of his brother armed services. But whatever confidence he'd had along those lines diminished in the face of having the command responsibility to utilize such forces in a professional way. Well, he had subordinate commanders in those other services to advise him. But it was his job to know more than just how to ask questions. And for Mancuso, that meant he'd have to go out and get his clothes dirty, seeing the practical side, because that was where the kids assigned to his theater would shed blood if he didn't do his job right. The team was a joint venture of the Atlantic Richfield Company, British Petroleum, and the largest Russian oil exploration company. The last of the three had the most experience, but the least expertise, and the most primitive methods. This was not to say that the Russian prospectors were stupid. Far from it. Two of them were gifted geologists, with theoretical insights that impressed their American and British colleagues. Better still, they'd grasped the advantages of the newest exploration equipment about as quickly as the engineers who'd designed it. It had been known for many years that this part of eastern Siberia was a geological twin to the North Slope region of Alaska and northern Canada, which had turned into vast oil fields for their parent countries to exploit. The hard part had been getting the proper equipment there to see if the similarity was more than just cosmetic. Getting the gear into the right places had been a minor nightmare. Brought by train into southeastern Siberia from the port of Vladivostok, the thumper trucks, they were far too heavy to airlift, had then spent a month going cross-country, north from Magdagachi, through Aym and Ust-Maya, finally getting to work east of Kazachia. But what they had found had staggered them. From Kazachia, on the river Yana, all the way to Kolymskaya, on the Kolyma, was an oil field to rival the Persian Gulf. The thumper trucks and portable computer-carrying seismic survey vehicles had shown a progression of perfect underground dome formations in stunning abundance, some of them barely 2,000 feet down, mere tens of vertical yards from the permafrost, and drilling through that would be about as hard as slicing a wedding cake with a cavalryman's saber. The scope of the field could not be ascertained without drilling test wells. Over 100 such wells, the chief American engineer thought, just from the sheer scope of the field. But no one had ever seen as promising or as vast a natural deposit of petroleum during his professional lifetime. The issues of exploitation would not be small ones, of course. Except for Antarctica itself, there was no place on the planet with a less attractive climate. Getting the production gear in here would take years of multi-stage investment, building airfields, probably building ports for the cargo ships that could alone deliver the heavy equipment, and then only in the brief summer months, needed to construct the pipeline which would be needed to get the oil out to market, probably through Vladivostok, the Americans thought. The Russians could sell it from there, and supertankers, more precisely called VLCCs or ULCCs, for very large to ultra-large crude carriers, would move it out across the Pacific, maybe to Japan, maybe to America or elsewhere, wherever oil was needed, which was just about everywhere. From those users would come hard currency. It would take many more years until Russia could build the wherewithal needed for its own industries and consumers to use the oil. But as such things happened, the cash generated from selling the Siberian crude could then be flipped and used to purchase oil from other sources, which would be much more easily transported to Russian ports and thence into existing Russian pipelines. The cash difference of selling and buying, as opposed to building a monstrous and monstrously expensive pipeline, was negligible in any case, and such decisions were usually made for political rather than economic reasons. At precisely the same time, and only 600 miles or 960 or so kilometers away, another geology team was in the eastern extreme of the Sayan mountain range. Some of the semi-nomadic tribes in the area, who had made their living for centuries by herding reindeer, had brought into a government office some shiny yellow rocks. Few people in the world have been unaware of what such rocks mean, at least for the preceding 30 centuries, and a survey team had been dispatched from Moscow State University, still the nation's most prestigious school. They had been able to fly in since their equipment was far lighter, and the last few 100 kilometers had been done on horseback, a wonderful anachronism for the survey team of academics, who were far more used to riding Moscow's fine subway system. The first thing they'd found was an 80-ish man living alone with his herd and a rifle to fend off wolves. This citizen had lived alone since the death of his wife, 20 years before, quite forgotten by the changing governments of his country, known to exist only by a few shopkeepers in a dreary village 30 kilometers to the south, and his mental state reflected his long-term isolation. He managed to shoot 3 or 4 wolves every year, and he kept the pelts as any hunter-herdsman might, but with a difference. First he took the pelts, and weighting them down with stones, set them in the small river that ran near his hut. In Western literature, there is the well-known story of Jason and the Argonauts, and their heroic quest for the Golden Fleece. It was not known until recently that the legend of the artifact sought was quite real. The tribesmen of Asia Minor had set the skins of sheep in their streams to catch the gold dust being washed down from deposits higher up, changing the pale wool fibers into something almost magical in appearance. It was no different here. The wolf pelts the geologists found hanging inside the old soldier's hut looked on first inspection to be sculptures by Renaissance masters, or even artisans of the pharaohs of dynastic Egypt, they were so evenly coated. And then the explorers found that each pelt weighed a good 60 kilograms, and there were 34 of them. Sitting down with him over the necessary bottle of fine vodka, they learned that his name was Pavel Petrovich Gogol, that he'd fought against the fascisti in the Great Patriotic War as a sniper, and remarkably was twice a hero of the Soviet Union for his marksmanship, mainly in the battles around Kiev and Warsaw. A somewhat grateful nation had allowed him to return to his ancestral lands. He was, it turned out, descended from the entrepreneurial Russians who'd come to Siberia in the early 19th century, where he'd been forgotten by the bureaucrats, who never really wondered much where the reindeer meat eaten by the locals came from, or who might be cashing his pension checks to buy ammunition for his old bolt-action rifle. Pavel Petrovich knew the value of the gold he found, but he'd never spent any of it, as he found his solitary life quite satisfactory. The gold deposit, a few kilometers upstream from the place where the wolves went for their last swim, as Pavel Petrovich described it with a twinkle in the eye and a snort of vodka, turned out to be noteworthy, perhaps as much as the South African strike of the mid-19th century, and that had turned into the richest gold mine in the history of the world. The local gold had not been discovered for several reasons, mainly relating to the dreadful Siberian climate, which had, first, prevented a detailed exploratory survey, and second, covered the local streams with ice so much of the time that the gold dust in the stream beds had never been noticed. Both the oil and rock survey teams had traveled into the field with satellite phones, the more quickly to report what they found. This both teams did, coincidentally on the same day. The Iridium satellite communication system they used was a huge breakthrough in global communications. With an easily portable instrument, one could communicate with the low-altitude constellation of dedicated communications satellites, which cross-linked their signals at the speed of light, which was almost instantaneous, but not quite, to conventional communications birds, and from there to the ground, which was where most people were most of the time. The Iridium system was designed to speed communications worldwide. It was not, however, designed to be a secure system. There were ways to do that, but they all required the individual users to make their security arrangements. It was now theoretically possible to get commercially available 128-bit encryption systems, and these were extremely difficult to break even by the most sophisticated of nation-states and their black services. Or so the salesman said. But the remarkable thing was that few people bothered. Their laziness made life a lot easier for the National Security Agency, located between Baltimore and Washington at Fort Meade, Maryland. There, a computer system called Echelon was programmed to listen in on every conversation that crossed the ether, and to lock in on certain code words. Most of those words were nouns with national security implications. But since the end of the Cold War, NSA and other agencies had paid more attention to economic matters, and so some of the new words were oil, deposit, crude, mine, gold, and others, all in 38 languages. When such a word crossed Echelon's electronic ear, the continuing conversation was recorded onto electronic media and transcribed, and, where necessary, translated, all by computer. It was by no means a perfect system, and the nuances of language were still difficult for a computer program to unravel, not to mention the tendency of many people to mutter into the phone. But where a goof occurred, the original conversation would be reviewed by a linguist, of which the National Security Agency employed quite a few. The parallel reports of the oil and gold strikes came in only 5 hours apart, and made their way swiftly up the chain of command, ending in a flash priority Special National Intelligence Estimate, called a SNE, destined for the President's desk right after his next breakfast, to be delivered by his National Security Advisor, Dr. Benjamin Goodley. Before that, the data would be examined by a team from the Central Intelligence Agency's Directorate of Science and Technology, with a big assist from experts on the payroll of the Petroleum Institute in Washington, some of whose members had long enjoyed a cordial relationship with various government agencies. The preliminary evaluation, carefully announced and presented as such, preliminary, lest someone be charged for being wrong if the estimate proved to be incorrect someday, used a few carefully chosen superlatives. "Damn," the president observed at 8:10 Eastern Standard Time. "Okay, Ben, how big are they really?" "You don't trust our technical weenies?" the National Security Advisor asked. "Ben, as long as I worked on the other side of the river, I never once caught them wrong on something like this. But damned if I didn't catch them underestimating stuff." Ryan paused for a moment. "But Jesus, if these are lowball numbers, the implications are pretty big." "Mr. President," Goodley was not part of Ryan's inner circle, "we're talking billions. Exactly how many, nobody knows. But call it $200 billion in hard currency earnings over the next 5 to 7 years at minimum. That's money they can use." "And at maximum?" Goodley leaned back for a second and took a breath. "I had to check. A trillion is 1,000 billion. On the sunny side of that number. This is pure speculation, but the guys at the Petroleum Institute that CIA uses, the guys across the river tell me, spent most of their time saying, 'Holy shit!'" "Good news for the Russians," Jack said, flipping through the printed SNE. "Indeed it is, sir." "About time they got lucky," POTUS thought aloud. "Okay, get a copy of this to George Winston. We want his evaluation of what this will mean to our friends in Moscow." "I was planning to call some people at Atlantic Richfield. They were in on the exploration. I imagine they'll share in the proceeds. Their president is a guy named Sam Sherman. Know him?
Ryan shook his head.
I know the name, but we've never met. Think I ought to change that?
If you want hard information, it can't hurt.
Ryan nodded.
Okay, maybe I'll have Ellen track him down.
Ellen Sumter, his personal secretary, was located 15 feet away through the sculpted door to his right.
What else?
They're still beating bushes for the people who blew up the pimp in Moscow. Nothing new to report on that, though.
Would be nice to know what's going on in the world, wouldn't it?
Could be worse, sir, Goodley told his boss.
Right.
Ryan tossed the paper copy of the morning brief on his desk.
What else?
Goodley shook his head.
And that's the way it is this morning, Mr. President.
Goodley got a smile for that. Chapter 4. Knob Rattling. It didn't matter what city or country you were in, Mike Riley told himself. Police work was all the same. You talked to possible witnesses. You talked to the people involved. You talked to the victim. But not the victim this time. Grisha Avseyenko would never speak again. The pathologist assigned to the case commented that he hadn't seen such a mess since his uniformed service in Afghanistan. But that was to be expected. The RPG was designed to punch holes in armored vehicles and concrete bunkers, which was a more difficult task than destroying a private passenger automobile, even one so expensive as that stopped in Dzerzhinsky Square. That meant that the body parts were very difficult to identify. It turned out that half the jaw had enough repaired teeth to say with great certainty that the decedent had indeed been Grigory Filipovich Avseyenko, and DNA samples would ultimately confirm this. The blood type also matched. There hadn't been enough of his body to identify. The face, for example, had been totally removed, and so had the left forearm, which had once borne a tattoo. The decedent's death had come instantaneously, the pathologist reported, after the processed remains had been packed into a plastic container, which in turn found its way into an oaken box for later cremation, probably. The Moscow militia had to ascertain whether any family members existed, and what disposition for the body they might wish. Lieutenant Provolov assumed that cremation would be the disposal method of choice. It was, in its way, quick and clean, and it was easier and less expensive to find a resting place for a small box or urn than for a full-sized coffin with a cadaver in it. Provolov took the pathology report back from his American colleague. He hadn't expected it to reveal anything of interest, but one of the things he'd learned from his association with the American FBI was that you checked everything thoroughly. Since predicting how a criminal case would break was like trying to pick a 10-play football pool 2 weeks before the games were played. The human minds who committed crimes were simply too random in their operation for any sort of prediction. And that had been the easy part. The pathology report on the driver had essentially been useless. The only data in it of any use at all had been blood and tissue types, which could be checked with his military service records, if they could be located, since the body had been so thoroughly shredded as to leave not a single identifying mark or characteristic. Though perversely, his identity papers had survived in his wallet, and so they probably knew who he had been. The same was true of the woman in the car, whose purse had survived virtually intact on the seat to the right of her, along with her ID papers, which was a lot more than could be said for her face and upper torso. Riley looked at the photos of the other victims. Well, one presumed they matched up, he told himself. The driver was grossly ordinary, perhaps a little fitter than was the average here. The woman, yet another of the pimp's high-priced hookers with a photo in her police file, had been a dish. worthy of a Hollywood screen test, and certainly pretty enough for a Playboy centerfold. Well, no more. So, Mishka, have you handled enough of these crimes that it no longer touches you? Provalov asked. Honest answer? Riley asked, then shook his head. Not really. We don't handle that many homicides, except the ones that happen on federal property, Indian reservations or military bases. I have handled some kidnappings, though, and those you never get used to. Especially, Riley didn't add, since kidnapping for money was a dead crime in America. Now children were kidnapped for their sexual utility, and most often killed in 5 hours, often before the FBI could even respond to the initial request for assistance from the local police department. Of all the crimes which Mike Riley had worked, those were by far the worst, the sort after which you retired to the local FBI bar. Every field division had one, and had a few too many as you sat quietly with equally morose and quiet colleagues, with the occasional oaths that you were going to get this mutt no matter what it took. And mostly the mutts were apprehended, indicted, and then convicted. And the lucky ones went to death row. Those convicted in states without a death penalty went into the general prison population, where they discovered what armed robbers thought of the abusers of children. But I see what you mean, Oleg Grigorievich. It's the one thing you have trouble explaining to an ordinary citizen. It was that the worst thing about a crime scene or autopsy photo was the sadness of it, how the victim was stripped not merely of life, but of all dignity. And these photos were particularly grisly. Whatever beauty this Maria Ivanovna Sablin had once had was only a memory now, and then mainly memories held by men who'd rented access to her body. Who mourned for a dead whore? Riley asked himself. Not the Johns, who'd move on to a new one with scarcely a thought. Probably not even her own colleagues in the trade of flesh and desire. And whatever family she'd left behind would probably remember her not as the child who'd grown up to follow a bad path, but as a lovely person who'd defiled herself, pretending passion, but feeling no more than the trained physician who'd picked her organs apart on the dented steel table of the city morgue. Is that what prostitutes were, Riley wondered? Pathologists of sex? A victimless crime, some said. Riley wished that such people could look at these photos and see just how victimless it was when women sold their bodies. Anything else, Oleg? Riley asked. We continue to interview people with knowledge of the deceased. Followed by a shrug. He offended the wrong people, an informant said, with a shrug of his own that showed how absurdly obvious the answer to the preceding question was. How else could a person of Avseenko's stature turn up dead in so spectacular a way? And what people are they? The militiaman asked, not expecting a meaningful answer. But you asked the question anyway because you didn't know what the answer was until you did. His colleagues from state security, the informant suggested. Oh? Who else could have killed him in that way? One of his girls would have used a knife. A business rival from the street would have used a pistol or a larger knife, but an RPG? Be serious! Where does one get one of those? He wasn't the first to voice that thought, of course, though the local police did have to allow for the fact that all manner of weapons, heavy and light, had escaped one way or another from the coffers of what had once been called the Red Army into the active marketplace of criminal weapons. So, do you have any names for us? The militia sergeant asked. Not a name, but I know the face. He's tall and powerfully built, like a soldier. Reddish hair, fair skin, some freckles left over from his youth. Green eyes. The informant paused. His friends call him the boy, because his appearance is so youthful. He was state security once,
but not a spy and not a catcher of spies. He was something else there, but I am not sure what.
The militia sergeant started taking more precise notes at this point, his pencil marks far more legible and much darker on the yellow page.
And this man was displeased with Ovseyenko?
So I have heard.
And the reason for his displeasure?
That I do not know, but Grigory Filipovich had a way of offending men. He was very skilled at handling women, of course. For that he had a true gift, but the gift did not translate into his dealings with men. Many thought him a Zhopnik, but he was not one of those, of course. He had a different woman on his arm every night, and none of them were ugly. But for some reason he didn't get along well with men, even those from state security, where he said he was once a great national asset.
Is that a fact? The militia sergeant observed, bored again. If there was anything criminals liked to do, it was boast. He'd heard it all 1,000 times or more.
Oh, yes. Grigory Filipovich claims to have supplied mistresses for all manner of foreigners, including some of ministerial rank, and says that they continue to supply valuable information to Mother Russia.
I believe it, the informer added, editorializing again. For a week with one of those angels, I would speak much.
And who wouldn't, the militiaman wondered with a yawn.
So how did Ovseyenko offend such powerful men? The cop asked again.
I have told you I do not know. Talk to the boy, perhaps he will know.
It is said that Grigory was beginning to import drugs, the cop said next, casting his hook into a different hole, and wondering what fish might lurk in the still waters.
The informant nodded.
That is true. It was said. But I never saw any evidence of it.
Who would have seen evidence of it?
Another shrug.
This I do not know. One of his girls, perhaps. I never understood how he planned to distribute what he thought about importing. To use the girls was logical, of course, but dangerous for them. And for him, because his whores would not have been loyal to him in the face of a trip to the camps.
So then, what does that leave? The informant asked rhetorically.
He would have to set up an entirely new organization, and there were also dangers in doing that, were there not? So yes, I believe he was thinking about importing drugs for sale, and making vast sums of money from it. But Grigory was not a man who wished to go to a prison, and I think he was merely thinking about it, perhaps talking a little, but not much. I do not think he had made his final decision. I do not think he actually imported anything before he met his end.
Rivals with the same ideas? The cop asked next.
There are people who can find cocaine and other drugs for you, as you well know.
The cop looked up. In fact, the militia sergeant didn't know that for certain. He'd heard rumbles and rumors, but not statements of fact from informants he trusted. Insofar as any cop in any city truly trusted any informant. As with many things, there was a buzz on the streets of Moscow, but like most Moscow cops, he expected it to show up first in the Black Sea port of Odessa, a city whose criminal activity went back to the Tsars, and which today, with the restoration of free trade with the rest of the world, tended to lead Russia in, well, led Russia to all forms of illicit activity. If there was an active drug trade in Moscow, it was so new and so small that he hadn't stumbled across it yet.